Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, David James Gonzalez, and I'm pleased to be speaking with George Sanchez, author of Boyle Heights, How a Los Angeles Neighborhood Became the Future of American Democracy, published within the American Crossroads series by the University of California Press in 2021. George Sanchez is professor of American Studies and Ethnicity and History at the University of Southern California. He is the author of the award-winning book, Becoming Mexican American, Ethnicity, Culture, and Identity in Chicano Los Angeles, published by Oxford University Press in 1993. His teaching and scholarship focuses on historical and contemporary topics of race, gender, ethnicity, labor, and immigration. He has published several articles in major research publications, public publications, and co-edited several volumes as well. He is past president of the American Studies Association and the 2020 to 2021 president of the Organization for American Historians. Hello, George, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Hi, DJ. How are you doing?
Well, it's great to have you on, George, again, as we're coming out of, maybe coming back into some type of normal. And excited to have you speaking with our audience today. And if we can, we'd just like to begin by having you tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm a first-generation college student. Both my parents emigrated from Mexico in the 1950s. And I was born in Boyle Heights in 1959. I grew up in various places around Los Angeles. My parents moved around, and as did I with them, and then left here at 17 to go to college in the East Coast. Did my undergraduate work at Harvard and my PhD work at Stanford. And I've been at USC for the past 24 years. My first job was at UCLA. Then I went to the University of Michigan and came back. So here to Los Angeles to USC. So that's a short biography.
I appreciate that. And if you wouldn't mind, if I can ask you, I love how you brought up, again, your first gen roots. Would you mind just briefly discussing, some of the initiatives that you've, taken throughout your career to support first gen students, both at USC and other places?
Sure. So I've done a number of things over the time I've been at USC. I've been a vice dean for diversity, and in that role, I've started most of USC's programs for first-generation college students. That also includes programs for students who came out of foster care youth and who were homeless before they arrived at USC. I also run the Mellon Mays Undergraduate Fellowship Program, which tries to identify sophomores and juniors that might go on to become faculty members in the future. I've done a lot of work with the McNair program, now at USC called the Gateway program. Also I've done a lot of public historical work. So goes back to, and a lot of it around Boyle Heights. So goes back to working with the Japanese American National Museum in an exhibition they did in 2001, 2002 on Boyle Heights. I work with the Jewish Historical Society of Southern California in a project called History in a Box, in which we prepared boxes for fourth grade teachers when they're teaching California history, teaching about the immigrant past of Boyle Heights. And then they asked us to do a variety of other boxes. And then for the last 5 years, I've been working on the Boyle Heights Museum, which is a partnership with Casa 0101 in Boyle Heights, which was founded by Josefina Lopez, the playwright who wrote Real Women Have Curves. And we work with her to do exhibitions for Boyle Heights residents on Boyle Heights history. And we are actually finishing up our fourth exhibition right now. Done all those things and continue to find more ways to get in trouble at USC.
Thanks for that. I appreciate you bringing up your public history work. I think that's a great way to segue into this book. And by saying, can you talk about the role that all that public history work played in, you know, getting you to work on this book for this period of time? And, you know, some of my thoughts while I was finishing up the book and I was thinking is, you know, man, just getting a sense of all that public history work that that you did over these years as a type of, you know, methodology that influenced this work. I mean, we look at oftentimes scholarly work like this and all the archival research that's done and that's a part of it and the oral history is a part of it and that's great. But if you could speak particularly to that connection of what did all that public history work do to get you to see that this is a project, this is a book that had to be written?
Sure. Well, I'll go back to the 1990s when I was an assistant professor at UCLA, and I started work on this project for a couple of different reasons. One was that, you know, being trained in Mexican-American history, and my first book sort of centering on the Mexican immigrant experience, I realized that as I was going through and working on that book, that every time I would come across Mexican interaction with other folks, I kind of set it aside, thought it was interesting, but it wasn't the major focus of that book. So I put it aside and I kept doing that over and over and over again, realizing that particularly in Boyle Heights, there was a lot of it. And so I was always intrigued by that. And then in 1992, the book was in press. And as it was released, you know, it was the aftermath of the LA riots in 1992. And a lot of people would ask me, oh, well, you know, how does your book talk about the LA riots? And it really didn't, as most history books aren't as contemporary. But I kept thinking that, you know, one of the things around the LA riots was that people kept asking, you know, can we all get along? Can we get along in multiracial neighborhoods? Isn't it really strange that people are living together in South Los Angeles? And isn't that the cause of so much of the tension? Mm-hmm. And I knew that I had all of this history that I had sort of put in the back corner on Boyle Heights and the way it groups got together. And so I decided to go back to that work and see if I could dig up more history. And what I really wanted was a kind of sense of how on the ground people got together, people lived their daily lives in mixed race communities. I taught a course at UCLA that very specifically where we recruited Chicano students through MECHA. We recruited Japanese American students through the Asian American organization. We recruited Jewish students through various Jewish student organizations. And actually together then everyone had to interview someone who grew up in the neighborhood. And that was very revealing. And the discussions in the class were very revealing. So I went on from that, left Los Angeles pretty soon after that, but was recruited to do work on this Japanese American National Museum exhibition that they wanted to do and head up the research team. And we had a multiracial group of researchers who were digging deep into the 1930s and 40s and people who had grown up there. And that was really it was a revelation. And part of what was happening for me was the kind of stories that I wanted to be able to tell. We were actually digging up as we interviewed people who had grown up there, weren't famous necessarily, but just, you know, about their experiences. And that kept coming back into what we did. And so I got very excited about being able to work on that book, got back to USC and started the process. And so wrote bits by bit by bit. But it really required me to retrain myself in Jewish American history, in Japanese American history, and other forms of urban and ethnic history that I hadn't really had a lot of training in. So that took a while. Of course, I became a dean. I did all kinds of things. And it wasn't until, you know, I stepped down from being a dean where I really felt I could finish this book up. So I published a number of different articles along the way and finally wrote the last couple of chapters more on the contemporary period. And, you know, felt at the end that I had really covered a lot of ground for Boyle Heights. And it required that kind of dexterity to go back and forth between the histories of a variety of different ethnic groups, but come up with new ways to talk about that history where people were interacting. Chapters would be written differently. It wouldn't be just talking about each group individually, but it would be really the way in which they interact and how to put the stories together.
Well, thanks for that. You got me thinking about, again, I mean, similar decisions and choices we make when we're in the archive. You come up, on interest material that's interesting, but it doesn't directly, again, relate to that current project. And you mentioned that you work with the community, you work with teaching students. Do you also see that, the field of history itself, this is very much American studies centric as well, is there something that's been changing in the field in these disciplines, scholarly disciplines, that maybe more embrace this type of analysis now?
Yes, certainly. I mean, I think what's one of the things that's occurred, and some of this has happened by with students of mine, which is that as the more they delve deep into local history, they realize that there's a kind of a relational history that has to be told in which things that affect one group and the ways in which a group is treated might in fact be translate into the way another group is treated. So Natalia Molina is probably one historian who's well known for that. And of course, we worked that out. She was a student of mine. So we worked that through in courses that she had taken with me. And, that's a very important new way of thinking about race and the way it's constructed, that it's not simply in relationship to one group, but the ways in which the history unfolds for one group may in fact influence another group. The other part is that I've always thought a lot about the ways in which people learn to be American as they are immigrants into communities. And if that community is multiracial, then they're learning that as part of an American status, an American condition. And depends on when it is. It depends on how it unfolds. But I think that's a really important part of understanding people's identity formation. So all of this has become more commonplace in U.S. history, and particularly U.S. urban history. When I started the project, certainly people tended to write histories of the barrio or histories of the ghetto that focused on single ethnic groups. And more, I think people are finding that that's not sufficient to really understand the complexity of urban space, certainly in the 20th or 21st century.
Right, right. And Boyle Heights creates, I'm trying to think of, other communities, and there are others, I think, in the United States, but that can provide this type of case study, right, where, multiracialism is the kind of shared experience, right? A neighborhood that, as maybe using our common, parlance or vernacular, has always kind of been majority-minority or minority-majority, whichever one prefers, right, in that way. And so you state the goal of the book is to relate this, story of this interracial or multiracial type of solidarity that exists in, Boyle Heights as the neighborhood develops, it's developing with Los Angeles. So can you take us back to early Los Angeles or the early development of Boyle Heights and tell us what was that like? Where does, how does this neighborhood begin, as, a piece of Los Angeles on its east side?
Sure. Like a lot of developing neighborhoods in 19th century Los Angeles, it was originally intended for profit and aimed at more upper class white migrants. Most of Los Angeles was aimed that way in the 1870s and 80s as the railroads connected Los Angeles to the rest of the United States. And I was intrigued by how that developed and why Boyle Heights essentially lost out on that bid. Mm-hmm. Other communities were much more successful. And I compare Boyle Heights, for example, to Pasadena that started later, but in fact could very quickly build Orange Grove Avenue and palm trees, and a set of Indiana investors would come and develop that, or so many of the beach communities by the turn of the century were attracting migrants. And Boyle Heights, partly because it was across the river, partly because the terrain had not yet been developed sufficiently with bridges over the river with enough irrigation, it kind of was slowed down by actually being in the city of Los Angeles, not being a separate city, being a kind of afterthought for Los Angeles. In fact, that's one of the reasons why the cemetery was built out at the edge of Boyle Heights, because they figured that's the farthest place that the city's going to develop, and so we can put Evergreen Cemetery out there as one of the city's first large cemeteries. Essentially, as investors started to realize by the 1890s and the 1900s that Boyle Heights was not going to be attracting a large number of very well-off Anglo homeowners, the people that owned property started to build smaller plots and started to focus on industrial development of Los Angeles. And they began to see it as a place that could attract immigrants that began to come into Boyle Heights to take advantage of the growing industrial factories that were developing along in the downtown area and in areas along the river and the railroads. And so as other neighborhoods were being built up and were being built up with racially restrictive covenants that kept African-Americans, Latinos, Asian-Americans, and many other white ethnic groups out of those neighborhoods, Boyle Heights remained open to most. So it was one of the few neighborhoods in Los Angeles, almost all on the east side or the south side, that welcomed everyone essentially to Boyle Heights. Became a place that everyone landed. Russian Molokans fleeing Russia from the Russo-Japanese War, Mexican immigrants coming up from the Mexican Revolution, African Americans who came escaping some of the violence of the South, particularly in urban areas, Japanese who were fleeing a Japan that was industrializing its agriculture and then seeing that the situation was better here than it was in Hawaii for many of those agricultural workers, Jews who were fleeing pogroms in Eastern Europe, and then moving west from Eastern cities, Italians, the same kind of industrial change, and a host of other European ethnics coming in. It became a place all those folks could land relatively good housing and close to jobs in industrial Los Angeles as that was developing. And so in the teens and the 20s, that's really who began to dominate Boyle Heights, a rather incredible mix from all over the world.
Thanks. You mentioned there, how Boyle Heights loses out, again, in this competition, for, again, affluent white migrants, mostly coming from, Midwest, but other parts of the country, the South, East, etc. It's early on in the book that you refer to Los Angeles as an innovator, in racial inequity, in racial formation for early Los Angeles. And the nation as it is. So tell us a bit more about, that's not what most people think about when they think about the history of Los Angeles or Southern California broadly, right? That you have cities in Southern California broadly that are innovating racial exclusion and leading to what you call urban apartheid. Can you speak more about how did that work? What did they do in Southern California, particularly without, again, the cover of, say Jim Crow laws like they had in the South?
Sure. What Los Angeles became known for two very specific things. One was that it innovated the use of urban zoning so that large parts of Los Angeles industry was zoned out of it. And particularly here, the west side of Los Angeles became an area where it became very difficult to build industrial factories in areas that were seen as really for residential use only. And industry itself was restricted to certain areas like the downtown area, like the area along the Los Angeles River, like the port area. Most of Los Angeles was therefore zoned for residences alone and small businesses. And this started with even restrictions against Chinese laundries in large parts of Los Angeles. So there was a whole history of zoning where Los Angeles was one of the innovators in the world on that kind of zoning. The second had to do with racial restrictions in home ownership. So to go along with the fact that only some areas were zoned for exclusively homeowner single family homes, the other thing you got is that they were not yet developed. So they were being built and embedded in their construction, in their initial paperwork to be bought and sold, were restrictive covenants against certain races, first being in, purchasing them, and then eventually in actually living in homes. And so you had Los Angeles most, because it was developing in the late 19th and early 20th century, a lot of the homes were new, but right off the bat, these whole swaths of community had racially restrictive covenants. And in fact, I go over in the book how some areas, this is dependent on people following up in the law, and some areas were seen as almost examples of what you shouldn't do, because the courts were willing to take people's homes away from them if, in fact, that law had been violated. So very clearly, African Americans were restricted tremendously to where they could purchase homes. But so were Latinos, so were Asian Americans, and in most parts of Los Angeles, so were Jews and Italians. And there were brand new areas on the South Side and Palos Verdes and so forth, where there was just very strict racial restrictions on who could purchase, and that wouldn't go away until the World War II era. Over time, even as things changed, the leader in this was the real estate companies, and particularly the Los Angeles Realty Board would really come down very hard on any realtor who would sell against these restrictions. And even as those laws were deemed as they were essentially deemed in the World War II era as being unconstitutional, not because they had racial restriction, but because they limited capitalism. They limited right. Who could buy and sell.
Like liberty of contract, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't so much about the racial restriction. So even as that went away, they found other ways in which to restrict the purchasing, the buying and selling of homes. During the World War II era, eventually the European ethnics were allowed into a lot of neighborhoods they had not been allowed into before on the west side of Los Angeles and the San Fernando Valley as it started to develop. But Mexicans, Blacks were still kept fairly rigidly restricted in terms of where they could purchase with what was now redlining, focused on communities that were seen as riskier mm-hmm. by the federal government and the real estate industry and the banks now offering mortgages. So again, this changes over the course of the 20th century, but the pattern remains the same, that there's more restriction in other areas. And so Mexicans and African Americans in particular are kept in communities like Boyle Heights, even as other groups that had lived there, like Jews, Italians, are allowed to move into other places.
Yeah, this history strikes so close to home for my family, particularly my dad's family. My dad grew up in L.A. broadly, in the San Fernando Valley, actually. And I'm trying to remember when he first shared this story with me, but it's probably near when I was getting close to adulthood, where, you know, he told me about his parents. Both his parents came from Southern Colorado. They're both, I mean, they're Mexican-American, and they both actually college educated, you know, from very small college, Adams State College, I think it was. Mm-hmm. But they come to LA, you know, in the post-war period, actually during the war, and some of my grandmother's sisters, so my great aunts, you know, they are Rosie the Riveters, right? Or yeah. Rosita, right? Riveters. And they're looking to buy a home, you know, during this period, right? Shortly after the war, like maybe some others, maybe a little flush with cash, but trying to capitalize off of the, you know, this government kind of aided expansion of suburban America, and they're shut out of it. You know, racially restrictive covenants are, you know, either that or, you know, again, just the racism of the real estate industry, people flat out refusing to show them homes in certain neighborhoods. And I mean, the only way perhaps that they don't end up, you know, staying in East LA is they were able to find a housing tract in Northridge that where the developer was Jewish and right. was willing to sell, right, to Mexican Americans. I mean, a very common story, I think, in perhaps LA for some ethnic groups. I want to segue this into a discussion of what you describe in the book is, you know, Boyle Heights develops because of this very, again, very eclectic and diverse mix of these migrants, as you explained, you know, coming from all over Europe, particularly, you know, very working class, you know, also many of them leftists, and kind of mixing into East LA, which, you know, has Mexicans, you know, has eventually there's African-Americans that are moving in, you know, at that time too. So Boyle Heights is developing at this type of multiracial space, and you describe it as there's a type of multiracial fellowship that develops in Boyle Heights, but that's existing at the same time of this dualism of this racialized urban apartheid in broader LA. You know, that you kind of have these two things going on, a really deeply segregated, again, Los Angeles, where, you know, the more diverse Boyle Heights become, it's kind of confirming it's this own racialized stereotype that's being developed around it. That's the space for non-whites or non-Anglo-Saxons, right? But then also in Boyle Heights, it's also developing as a space where there are conflicts, there's struggles, and there's even divisions within the community, but there is this sense of multiracial fellowship that is developing. Can you discuss those things happening at the same time? You know?
Sure. So I think in many ways, the 1920s is a period in which you've got these different people pouring into Boyle Heights, but the system seems to be working in that, you know, people are finding employment. They're near places where they can work. They're able to settle in Boyle Heights into various kinds of homes, some renting, some purchasing homes. And the community seems to be working. The largest part of the community is Jewish. It's about 40% of the population by 1930. And Jews are coming with a variety of backgrounds, and it's particularly for working class Jews. There's other Jewish communities on the west side that are attached to Hollywood, which are much more exclusive and upper income. But the working class Jews tend to be moving in where they work in the garment industry downtown, or they work in other industries. That's who's moving into Boyle Heights, along with Mexicans, Italians, African Americans, other people. What really happens is that the labor unions start to develop also in Boyle Heights because of that history that those groups are bringing in. Particularly the Jewish migrants will bring in the garment workers, the carpenters union, the hatters, all the different groups. And Boyle Heights becomes in the late 20s, a place for union activity in a city which is notoriously anti-union. It is very much an open shop city, a place in which the city leaders don't want to see union activity, even as they're developing industry. There's not huge conflicts. There's huge conflicts around this issue early in the 20th century, but then the real conflicts begin to develop in the 1930s when the economy goes south and people are struggling. There are no jobs anymore, and people are struggling within that. So you have in the 1930s, more militant unionism, more attempts to make those unions multiracial. And at the same time, the government is looking for scapegoats. And of course, Mexican repatriation happens in the early 1930s, where Mexicans are targeted, often Mexicans from Boyle Heights, particularly the flats area of Boyle Heights, trying to be thrown out by the government, seen as, well, if we lose these folks somehow, we will recover from the Depression. Of course, the Depression is a much larger cataclysmic event than that. You get local solutions, supposed solutions, that don't work, but that still attack communities in Boyle Heights. From Mexican repatriation, then to eventually what you would have is Japanese internment in the 1940s, where people who live in Boyle Heights are really targeted as part of the problem. And what then develops is that people begin to do a lot more work across these ethnic groups in labor unions, in other entities, and eventually in civil rights organizations to protect the neighborhood and to try to protect kind of a working class sensibility in the neighborhood itself. So Boyle Heights becomes in the 1930s, one of the principal places that a commitment to Franklin Roosevelt and the Democratic Party and the New Deal sort of takes hold, especially FDR's commitment to unionism as being part of the New Deal coalition. And you get the development, particularly of second generation ethnic Americans, Mexican Americans, Jewish Americans, as part of the New Deal coalition. People seeing that relationship to politics as being absolutely critical. And then, of course, when the war hits, you get a variety of people sort of signing up for that war in various kinds of ways. So throughout this whole period, the neighborhood is sort of coming together even more decidedly to protect its own and to try to take care of folks who are in need in the neighborhood, and people seeing that that there is a time for kind of working class people to kind of bind themselves together. And that's really what's happening. And that's a deep legacy in Boyle Heights. It continues well into the end of the 20th century.
You mentioned repatriation and internment. These are things that I'm sure many of our listeners have, and that is specifically repatriation of Mexicans, not just Mexican national, but U.S. citizens with Mexican ethnicity during the Depression to Mexico, and as well, of course, the internment of Japanese Americans. You mentioned these things. These are things that are experienced within this one community. On top of that, there's kind of this 1-2-3 combo of that you discussed. There's not only repatriation in the 30s, there's also, again, internment in the 40s during the war, but a lot of throughout this process, beginning in the 30s and later on, you have, urban development or redevelopment or slum clearance, right? So this one community is experiencing all of these things. Can you discuss what did that mean to you as you're studying this area and you're speaking with people that have experienced all three of these things, right? Things and key moments, key developments in American history, but rarely, do we find one community that was so, where the impact of these things have been so concentrated.
Right. Part of what I thought was important for me to identify is that city leaders, and often the very same city leaders, see the populations in Boyle Heights as disposable. Yeah. Boyle Heights is right across the river from downtown Los Angeles, where City Hall is, where county offices are. And so often it's like the first area that one thinks of for renewal. And renewal often means if we move out this population, then new visions of what might be in the future for Los Angeles can be constructed. And that has an influence in why Boyle Heights is targeted for Mexican repatriation, but why also, the Japanese American community is going to be particularly focused on in internment. And the removal of those folks will will take place with some of the same officials that actually had organized Mexican repatriation. The same city and county officials, the same departments of social services. In addition, you've got the movement out of people, because that's the same period that begins the process of building freeways. And then during the war, of constructing public housing that will first displace areas seen as slums. All of this is kind of in a larger framework of seeing areas that are disposable and people that are disposable, that can be moved around at will, without really taking much into account in terms of their rights. That includes, of course, the fact that 2/3 of the people repatriated were actually born in the United States, so that they're being moved back to deported to a country they'd never been to. And of course, the same goes for internment, which is 2/3 of the people who are sent away in internment are U.S.-born Japanese Americans. Their citizenship doesn't matter a whole lot in this kind of configuration of the 1930s and 40s. And I think that's a critical thing to keep in mind. And so even as this group is living in a community supporting FDR, thinking of itself as very American, and Boyle Heights is the quintessential American community, they are shocked by what the government would do to their neighbors, sometimes to themselves. So to use the high school, Roosevelt High School, as an example, you know, 1/3 of the high school in 1942 was Japanese American. And so when people saw that it was their student body president or their newspaper editor that was removed possibly enemies of the state, they just didn't believe it. It didn't make sense to them. And this is even in a community that was 40% Jewish, in which Jews are signing up to fight for the U.S. during World War II at a huge clip. You had people visiting their neighbors and their classmates at Santa Anita Racetrack in the summer of 42 on a regular basis. You had all of this kind of sense that this was an attack on people that were close to them, and that it violated parts of what they thought was American society. And so I'm very intrigued by that tension in kind of neighborhood identity, that, of course, you know, it's a wartime, and so lots of things are changing and happening, but these things sort of go together, particularly from the vantage point of seeing the way that local officials treated this particular community as utterly able to be able to be moved about like this. And literally the same officials. I do some work on John Anson Ford, who's a LA County supervisor who comes in 1934. And he is trying to resurrect Mexican repatriation throughout his tenure. And in fact, he finds himself on December 7th, 1941, in Mexico, trying to strike a new deal for repatriation when Pearl Harbor happens. And all of a sudden he has to come back. And immediately he transfers into trying to find solutions, because the first impulse of the government is to arrest people who were well known in the community because they were religious leaders, civic leaders, and that leaves a lot of Japanese American families without the head of the household. And all of a sudden, the county has to take care of these families that were left that way. Well, okay, so maybe we should move them. Maybe we should push them together and have the government take care of, you know, this, the same kind of impetus that had happened in Mexican repatriation. So I'm very intrigued by the interconnections of this, often with the same government officials.
Yeah, I mean, there are several parts of, this part of the book that really, I think, shook me. I mean, one of them, I mean, just the, as you mentioned, the letters that occurred between classmates of Japanese peers that were interned, writing to, you know, their classmates, whether African American, Mexican, or some other ethnicity, about what their experience was like. Again, some of these classmates going to visit them. I mean, that just shocked me. It's what I love about, frankly, I think studying and exploring history. I'm always surprised. You know, there's some of those moments for you. I mean, I don't know, it was the John Anson Ford story too. I forget, he's got this, there's a friend of his that's Japanese American. And so he has like some type of friendship with them. I can't remember if it's a business relationship or what, but this own close associate of his is also interned. And, you know, this associate writes him a letter, right? Trying to explain him what this process of like about how his rights have been stripped from him. But meanwhile, they have this, again, long relationship. And you just feel the tension, you know, again, in that letter of what's going on, you know, in this period. I mean, so again, just any other moments like that, just you come across a document, you hear, again, one of those experiences, just, I mean, you know about these developments, you've known about them for a long time, but just, they just shake you and they really reposition your view of how people are experiencing this on the ground in a whole new light.
The story, you know, there's those, of course, of people who are on the, you know, in the government. It gives you a sense that you know, Japanese Americans are integrated into the life of Los Angeles and of this neighborhood in a way. It's not simply a separate entity in a separate community, but it's mixed. I like to always refer to the story of Molly Wilson, who's this African American teenager who I met when she was in her 70s and brought us these letters to an event that I sponsored. And these were the return letters from her Japanese American classmates from internment camps. She had been furious because her closest friends, as she entered Roosevelt High School, were being taken away from her. So she decided as a personal protest to write them each week. And so she had all of the return letters that came from her friends, and they're now deposited in the Japanese American National Museum Library. But, you know, there was always this interesting kind of dynamic, because you don't think of, you know, girl friendships as having that power, particularly for 15, 16, 17 year olds. But here you had this real impact on this one African-American young woman who felt, you know, my friendships are being violated. And I thought about that for a very long time. And we kept wanting to interview her with her friends, and we finally were able to do that through the Japanese American National Museum. And it turns out that they told the story, the Japanese American friends, that made everything make sense, in that Molly had grown up in Boyle Heights, and they had all gone to middle school together before high school, mm-hmm. at Hollenbeck Junior High School. And, you know, Molly had experienced racism at the junior high. She had been a very popular kid. She was going to be running for a student body president and in the middle school. Clearly she would win. And the principal called her in and suggested that she not run, that it wouldn't be a good symbol for the school that Molly became the class president of Hollenbeck High School, Hollenbeck Junior High. This is the late 1930s. And, you know, Molly was very proud. Her parents had taught her to be proud. She sort of left, didn't know what to do. And her friends, all of whom were also very popular Japanese American students, said, Molly, you know, we're not running for anything. We're all boycotting the student government election if they won't let you become president. And so they all stood by her. And it made now for me sense of why, as she was going into high school, she wanted to protest her wonderful friends and classmates being sent away, because these people had already stood up for her. And so that gives you a sense of how friendships are constructed at those ages and how powerful they are. You know, these are not simply bystanders. These are people whose lives are intertwined with each other and have supported each other even through tough times. And so the violation of one or the other is going to make a huge difference for people. And I think that's the way the Japanese American internment felt for a lot of the people that grew up in Boyle Heights. It felt like a violation of their community and their friendships. And Molly's life kind of spoke to that in really powerful ways.
I love that story. Thanks for sharing it, you know, here for our audience. And it's definitely one of the strongest that comes across in the book itself. I'm thinking about, you know, the post-war transitions that occur in Boyle Heights. You mentioned at one point, Jews are 40%, Jewish Americans are 40% of the population. But then very quickly, right over the post-war decades of the 50s and 60s, with this, you know, vast, you know, again, suburbanization, and economic expansion, post-war expansion that occurs, the demographics of Boyle Heights changed drastically. So could you, you know, speak to that? And then also, what did that mean to kind of the, how did that change in ways the political culture of, I don't know if that's the right question, but it definitely, the demographics are changing. And then so these type of coalitions that are formed, you know, in the 20s, 30s, 40s, et cetera, they're very multiracial. They still have to be for some time in the 50s and 60s, but it starts to change, doesn't it? There's a demographic change that's creating a different political calculus that it's occurring there, right?
It does start to change. But what's interesting to me is that it actually changes more towards a real movement and interaction across, particularly between Jews and Mexicans, that you might say is more to the left and more powerful. What happens is that the first Jews that move out, of course, are the ones that are less political, more religious. The Orthodox community moves out fairly quickly during the war and then immediately after the war. But Boyle Heights begins to be seen as a place that, well, this is a place where Yiddish culture, leftist culture, radical culture still exists. And in fact, it's one of the few areas in the anti-communist late 40s and 1950s, one of the few areas that still has a kind of leftist tradition. So leftist Jews actually stay. They stay longer than anyone else. And that has a lot of repercussions for Boyle Heights. It leads directly to one thing is that both communities sort of feel like the empowerment of Mexican Americans is absolutely critical to the future of Los Angeles. And through the community services organization, people in both the Mexican community, the Mexican American community, and the Jewish community begin to organize to try to find a leader that they can put into the city council that would represent the neighborhood. And they choose Edward Roybal, who loses in 1947, but then between 47 and 49, there's a whole effort to get Mexican-American voters registered in massive numbers, and he will end up winning the election in 1949 for city council from the region. What I find fascinating about that is that yes, it's about Mexican-American empowerment, and it's critically brought together by a group of union-affiliated Mexican-Americans, but at the same time, it's also being funded and supported by a larger Jewish American contingent, some of whom are still in Boyle Heights, some who have a history with Boyle Heights. That becomes a way of kind of moving things forward. There's also other organizations that try to maintain themselves even as Jews are moving out. The Michigan Soto Jewish Community Center is a key one where it kind of leads in all kinds of multiracial activities during the late 40s and 50s. And then very left organizations like the Committee for the Protection of the Foreign Born that has communist and socialist members. And it's trying to protect people who are going to suffer under the McCarran-Walter Act and be deported because of their left activity. They're supporting Mexicans, Jews, Italians, other people who are Japanese, or being targeted for deportation, even though they might have become U.S. citizens. So it becomes a really fascinating place in the 40s and 50s to watch this transformation occur. As the community becomes more Mexican, it also becomes in some ways more politicized. And Roybal is kind of the chief person there. He often is alone on his votes in the city council. He often, for example, he's the only city council person who's against a communist registration act that gets passed. He's the one that's trying to defend Mexicans who are being sent away from Chavez Ravine. He's the one trying to stop the freeway construction that's plowing through Boyle Heights. So though he's often voting alone or with very few liberals, he his power comes from this community that is really organized to support those actions. And he's able to do quite a bit in kind of integrating Boyle Heights into the larger political stratum of at least getting city services to Boyle Heights.
As you're covering that, I'm also, so we have this transition in the post-war period, particularly of, right, Boyle Heights becoming increasingly more Mexican, coming to look a lot like the East LA that perhaps most of our listeners are most familiar with. And this is, again, just a microcosm of again, transformations that are occurring throughout the country, which you do a great job of connecting what's going on in Boyle Heights, to the larger national and transnational movements. And so I'm thinking of Boyle Heights, again, as this place that, as you describe, for this development of this multiracial type of progressive democratic culture, right, from, again, these expatriates, if you will, or, right, migrants from all over, southern and eastern Europe, right, from Japan, again, migrants from Mexico and African Americans. So that's, this Boyle Heights of kind of the early to middle 20th century. Then we have this transition to, again, an increasingly much more, Mexican, but Latino and immigrant dominant Boyle Heights. Can you explain how that, again, that took this development of this multiracial progressive democratic type of, culture and added, the whole like transnational aspect on it, right? Where, yeah. I mean, Boyle Heights comes to, represent in many ways, I'm thinking as we're talking here, kind of these key transitions in the Democratic Party, if you will, and this push towards increasing the multiracialism, and now one would argue a type of transnationalism, in some extent, forcing the party to realize it's the politics just go beyond even nationality. But Boyle Heights seems to be like the epicenter in many ways of this type of these transformative movements.
So part of what happens is those public housing units that were constructed in the World War II era by the 50s and 60s now are housing some of the most vulnerable migrants to Los Angeles. And that includes both Mexican immigrants and particularly Mexicans coming out of the Bracero program, but also African Americans coming up from the South. And so they become multiracial in a different way with both African-Americans and Mexican-Americans. And that leads directly to the student movements in the East L.A. schools. And I look particularly at Roosevelt and Garfield and Lincoln High School, where there's a student walkouts in 1968, really with Mexican-Americans learning from what they've seen in terms of the Watts riots and in terms of the war on poverty protests that were in the mid-60s, leading directly into a public posture of walking out of their high schools to protest the horrible teaching conditions, that the learning conditions they had in those schools. That's very much a part of this transfer to a transnationalism, because though it involves Mexican-Americans primarily and African-Americans, it's also in the wake of continued movement at the very same time of now a new Mexican immigrant community coming in the post-65 era, many of whom are undocumented. Mm-hmm. And so in the 60s, the the 70s and 80s, then you've got a whole movement, even as the Chicano movement sort of takes hold in Los Angeles in the late 60s and 70s, you've now got new Mexican immigrants who are undocumented forming a larger and larger proportion of the Boyle Heights population. And I trace that through a lot of things, through issues that were happening at USC Medical Center with the forced sterilization of Mexican immigrant women. And eventually in the 80s and 90s, with the creation of new organizations, new political organizations that try to once again protect the neighborhood, but now not focus so much like the community service organization was on registering people to vote or naturalization, but rather on a politics of non-electoral democracy. And so the Mothers of East LA formed in 1986, continuing on to try to keep city and state officials from putting a prison in East Los Angeles or then toxic waste facilities. They're a key part of this coming out of the Catholic parishes in Boyle Heights and really pushing city leaders, city, county, and state officials not to put these kind of eyesores for the community into neighborhoods in or near Boyle Heights. And then also I'm interested in the development of Homeboy Industries in the 90s because Father Gregory Boyle, who starts Homeboy Industries as an alternative for young gang members away from gangs and towards jobs, he's very interested in the fact that these folks coming out of mixed status families, undocumented families, often don't have a lot of options in terms of the economic jobs they might get. And so he's very much that this is a product of what these folks in the 1990s are confronting, and he needs to provide other alternatives that are more positive for them. So you get this real transition, but again, Boyle Heights people coming together to find new strategies to try to incorporate its residents into a political force to protect the neighborhood. That's kind of what I'm most interested in, and I think what's the carryover from the earlier period, even though these are obviously newcomers to Boyle Heights.
No, definitely. Yeah, it seems that there's, right, the newcomers are, if you will, they acculturate into that type of, that culture, that multiracial, type of, culture of appreciation of, fighting for each other, sharing an experience. On top of that, we haven't talked much about it, but I mean, the role of women in all of these struggles, you do such a phenomenal job, weaving this as a thread throughout the book. Women in, the 1930s in the labor industry, what's the ILGWU, right, or others, inspiring future generations, their daughters or other young women in the community that eventually lead the blowouts, right, or the student protests, or, right, come to, right, form Mothers of East LA, or, they're running for public office. But coming from, Boyle Heights and East LA broadly, with all these strong women involved in these progressive social movements, right, they're at the forefront of seeing the need of combining all these issues, right, that it's, this is not just, immigration is not one issue, and youth criminalization or mass incarceration is on another issue, or right, environmental destruction. I mean, all these are things that are being faced by this community. Women are at the forefront of this whole thing. I mean, that's just another thread and theme that's all throughout this book.
That's right, and it means that you have to dig to get those stories. You have to find it both in the archives, but also particularly in oral histories. And in telling this and really listening to all the people who are actively involved, I think that's the benefit of the time that I took and the real power of those stories in shaping a neighborhood and a community. When you take it at that level, you see the consistency of women's activism pretty regularly.
Well, certainly, right? Because it's not in the most traditional type of archives, right? The public records, often that you see that it's in talking to people within the community, people that led these struggles, that experienced this history. They're the ones that tell you, right? Oh yeah, you need to know about so-and-so, right? So-and-so did this, but he or she's not in any of the other documents, right? That's so right. Speaking again to me, all that public history work you did and the time it takes, yes, to craft a narrative and a history in this way, that covers so much. Our time is short, and I want to get your take as we pull back and look at the broader significance of this book in Boyle Heights. As you describe, both the beginning and the end, Boyle Heights is a sort of laboratory of multiracial democracy, right, that is occurring all throughout, right, the much of this 20th century and now into the 21st century. And I can't help but think of your book coming out now at this time when it seems to me, those of us that are from California, right, we're very familiar with Proposition 187 from the mid-90s that sought to criminalize undocumented immigrants and strip social services, public services from them, public education, health, any type of medical care. It sought to turn these agencies into kind of like deputized, right, the Border Patrol. I mention this because to me, it seems, and maybe to some of us, it seems like you know, the country as a whole is having this Prop 187 moment, right? This backlash against the increasing demographic change, not just multiracialism, but, you know, kind of the vast multiculturalism that's been occurring for decades, the transnational movement of people. And I just want to get your thoughts on, you know, Boyle Heights as, again, this laboratory of democracy. What's the message you hope readers take away from it, reading it within this context? You know, we are not out of Trump's America, not by a long shot, right? We are not against this backlash, against this, you know, diversification, something that Boyle Heights is a case in point, has been experiencing for decades, right, through these global and domestic transformations.
Well, I think, you know, the United States is in a critical crossroads at this point where it has to learn what is it going to mean for us to be a multiracial democracy, you know, as if we move forward. And can we do it? You know, it's a question mark. And how do we learn? And I think you learn from communities like Boyle Heights. You learn to see what it's done over time and what it's done recently to integrate all kinds of residents into a sense of community pride in terms of neighborhood resilience, in terms of a place that families will be proud to raise their children in, and that where you have people on a regular day-to-day basis really struggling, but fighting to survive and to prosper for their family and for the future generations. That to me is what a multiracial democracy has to be. It's not going to just happen out of Washington or out of Sacramento. It's got to happen at the neighborhood level. It's got to happen with people coming across their differences and really working together and finding common goals and common solutions to problems that most neighborhoods are facing in this country. So I think that's why a history of Boyle Heights is so important, because I think you can learn how this particular neighborhood overcame its differences, really fought together, despite poverty, despite differences in the neighborhood. It really fought to survive and to prosper. And I think that's a critical lesson to be learned in today's United States. While people think that it's, you know, the solutions are sometimes to become more nativist, to force people out, I tend to think that a multiracial democracy is to try to find methods of inclusion that really fortify our experiences as Americans and as, families and residents that can come together and learn how to thrive together. And I think, you know, you saw that through the pandemic. You saw that in Boyle Heights, across the board. And you increasingly just see it on a day-to-day level. It's from communities like Boyle Heights that we're going to learn that a multiracial democracy is our future if we are willing to do that kind of work that is required to keep a democracy alive. And so that's what I hope people take from the book.
Well, George, thank you for your time and for, you know, sharing both your thoughts and experiences with this wonderful book. I appreciate you coming on New Books Latino Studies.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.